Okay, welcome back. Thank you so much for being here. It's nice to see. I haven't seen some of you for a while. Good to have you in the space again. So I started talking about this text that came out of my desire to start to support lay practice. And as I've been saying that it's actually pretty hard to keep one's practice balanced and vivid, alive, outside of a kind of residential practice setting. Because we tend to slide to one side or the other in our zazen. And the lack of clear, explicit instruction about Zen meditation is part of the problem. It's been an orally transmitted tradition for a very, 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 very long time. That is, one receives instruction face to face. And so the texts about Zen meditation are actually very poetic and not super explicit, especially if you've studied something like the Pali Canon or the Indo-Tibetan tradition. You go, wait a second, how come we don't talk about meditation in Zen? Isn't this the meditation school? And so my training with White Plum Lineage and Chosen and Hogen, and then with Shoto Harada Roshi, and then the Indo-Tibetan tradition has led me to feel like we can learn a lot and bolster, clarify our practice of Zen from these other traditions. There are many things that are explicit in these other traditions that are poetic or implicit in the teachings of Zen. So I talked about this a little bit a few weeks ago, but some of you weren't here, so I want to touch again on the practice sequence that I have been inviting in particular. So one could say that Buddha's meditation is a balance of shamatha and vipassana. Shamatha is calm abiding. It's like a literal translation. We could talk about that as one-pointedness or concentration. We could say it's the aspect of letting go of thought so that the mind ground becomes apparent. Basic clarity, basic emptiness. And then vipassana means to see. It means to see into. And the idea is that when you have shamatha, you can actually have vipassana. When you have some calmness, you can actually see the nature of this person who's sitting here meditating. Who is it that's sitting here meditating? Why are you convinced there is such a person? Because there's this experience of awareness. Nobody can tell you that you are not aware here and now. But what is that? And how intimate is that which is doing the meditation? It at some point became the characteristic of Chinese meditation, and this influenced Chan, the Chinese form of Zen, to have shamatha and vipassana be simultaneous. And in the Kaodong school, which became the Soto school in Japan, this was called serene illumination. Serene being the shamatha, the resting, the emptying the mind side. Vipassana being the bright awakeness that is simultaneous with that resting. Ideally, if someone is doing a practice like Shikantaza, it has that quality. We're not just hanging out on our meditation cushions trying to feel cozy. There is a quality of calmness, but there's also a quality of vividness. Because otherwise, we don't see into the nature of things. But if we only have vividness and we don't have calmness, then there's a striving quality, and we're just trying to make something happen in our practice. and it doesn't have the nourishment of restfulness. So in this way of practicing, we first divide these two aspects and then unify them. So I was inviting you into shamatha, right? Which for many people who encounter Zen teachings, the basic shamatha practice is to follow the breath. I don't like the term follow the breath. That implies that you're behind it. You're not behind it. That's why we need vipassana, because we think we're behind it. There's nobody behind the breath. We attune to the flow of the breath. For shamatha, you could just as easily be working with sound. You could be listening. You could be feeling the palms of your hands. I've actually found great benefit and often recommend people work with just resting their eyes on a candle flame. No, it's not traditional Zen practice, but that probably had a lot to do with it's not super practical when you've got, you know, 150 people sitting on bamboo mats in a room to have candles there. It's easy to become dogmatic about tradition. Shamatha, you can work with any object. Any phenomena of your senses can be used as a means to rest your attention. Any. You know, the breath has its benefits, has its energetic benefits. So we begin with shamatha. This is the basic coming to rest. I like to emphasize that we can mistake the side effect of shamatha for the primary intention. And I think this can clear up a lot of confusion. When we're doing concentration practice, the intention is primarily that your attention and the object, they stick together. They're touching as much as possible. You're connected, you're in contact. You might have a feeling of being rooted, of being deeply connected, of intimate engagement. When it ripens, we feel like we're merged with that which is meditating, and that which is meditated upon become like this, right? We have that experience, a kind of unified state. That's not the goal, but it's damn nice, and it's very supportive. That is the primary intention, is attention and object, whether it's attention and breath, attention and sound, attention and koan, to be together. Secondary is whether there are or aren't a lot of thoughts. And I think this is helpful to clarify, because you can be practicing very well. You can be engaged in concentration, and still the mind is emitting thoughts. That's what it does. It emits thoughts. I think it was Uchiyama Roshi who said something like, the brain emits thoughts. You could think of it like that. That's what it does. We don't actually want to suppress that, because we lose vitality. We lose actually the brightness of mind when we suppress the mind at all. And that's not our practice. So when you're doing the shamatha phase, if you're practicing in this threefold way, the main thing is just, let's call it staying in the groove. If you do that for long periods of time, that tends to lead to quiescence. Right? That tends to lead to less thoughts, because you're not engaging them. You're intimate with the object. It tends to lead to a more empty mind, which leads to tranquility, which is all good. But if you sit down and you decide that your meditation is about not having thoughts, I mean, of course you could do that, but that's not actually the point. So So the first part, and if you're doing this practice at home, I would encourage you to, you have to divide up your time in a skillful way. For some people, weighing really heavily this first aspect of the practice, I think would be the wiser thing. Both because you want the refreshment and the stability of that quality of presence. And because we're building the skill. We're building the skill of being able to really be here. In the, one of the ways that things unfold, for example, in the white plum lineage, is that one, once they develop a certain amount of shamatha, breath, concentration, power, then they might be given a koan. Then they might be given an insight practice. And so we're replicating that larger unfolding of practice in each session. So at some point after doing shamatha, you would move on. And I don't know exactly how you would do that. I guess you'd have to glance at a clock or something. Maybe you set a timer. Maybe you can feel that, okay, I practiced for 40 minutes. I've been sitting for 15 or 20 now. Then you turn to the insight phase. The basic idea is that whether you think it's been spectacular or lousy, you have affected your mind by the concentration you've endeavored in. Right? To some degree or another, and that depends on many things, depends on our practice background, depends on how long we sat for. The mind is more serviceable. That was the term the Buddha used when he described the states of concentration that he cultivated wildly to a wild depth that most of us are not interested in, and have mastered the ability to focus the mind in different ways. He said, I made my mind serviceable, malleable, and wieldy. You find that in the Pali Canon. And to say it more simply, the practice of insight becomes possible to us because we're not fully caught up in the mind stream. We might have initiated ourselves into the distinction between the not ultimate distinction, but the relative distinction between awareness and that which arises within it. You come to that place where you can see thoughts come and go without entanglement. That which sees thought come and go is free of the coming and going of thought. And so we take that further. Now, I have found this practice in various ways in Chan texts and Zen texts many times. In the Dzogchen tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, it's most explicitly delineated how do you do this particular practice. And this particular practice, there is a name for it. I can't even pronounce it in Tibetan, so I'm not going to tell you what it is. But basically, I'm not going to tell you the name. I'm telling you how to do it. The basic thing is that you put awareness, attention, directly on thoughts. Now, in so doing, you reinforce the distinction between your attention and the content, or your awareness and the content of awareness. Even to make this effort is a skillful maneuver. Right, you're deepening the experience and confidence that you are not your thoughts. Yeah. Again, this is not an ultimate truth here, but it's a deeper relative truth. You are not your thoughts. You can look at them. It's a little bit like head in a fishbowl. That's the best visual metaphor I have for this. So first of all, to do this practice, you have to have your eyes open. I've tried it with the eyes closed, and it's much harder to do. When the eyes are closed, there is less clarity about the nature of mind. It's excellent, of course, sometimes for shamatha practice, where all we're doing is letting go and merging with object. But for clarity, for vividness about what consciousness is, the eyes closed, I think, is a disadvantage. And certainly in the Dzogchen tradition, it was taught, no, you can't do this with your eyes closed. So the skillful means is your eyes are open, you put your awareness directly on thought forms. That's the first step. There's a little bit of dissonance for some folks at first doing this. It's weird. We don't know if we're doing it right. We don't know what the effect's supposed to be. The first element of that is just doing this will help you get more vivid clarity on what goes on in your mind. There's a teaching you find in Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, and I think in poetic ways in Zen, that talks about there's the coarse thoughts and movements of the mind that we usually catch, especially if we're beginning to practice mindfulness. We're aware of like the big chunky judgmental thoughts or the big excited ice cream thoughts or everything in between. We get those. But there's a subtler undercurrent of thought. There's like a kind of whispery narrative that's going on. We quiet the louder discriminations going on in the mind, but there are more, there are layers with less volume. As you practice this meditation, you help illuminate more of those layers. You want those to be penetrated by awareness. We want to shine through it all. But the doing of the practice is just as simple, and you could try it right now. Eyes open and put attention directly on thought. If you're having the experience of a thoughtless mind, what is that? Put your attention directly on that thoughtless mind. In doing so, duality collapses, even for a moment. In doing so, the substance of the meditator and things that go through the mind dissolve, if only for a moment. That's part of the point. We're thawing the solidity of the self in a very direct way, if only momentarily. A fruit of this kind of practice, if you do it over time, and of course this is not the only way to do something like this, is that you have confidence in the insubstantiality of your mind. It's a little scary if you're getting older. As you get older, you lose some of your short-term memory. You're like, the last thing I need is more insubstantiality of my mind. But we hear things like all phenomena are empty, or everything is emptiness or is spaciousness. And where the rubber hits the road is our own cogitation. We need to see that this mind is empty. These thoughts have so much power to pull us this way and that way. These thoughts which carry so much authority. By doing this kind of practice, we see just how ephemeral and dreamlike every thought is. And what this means is that we can, whether we're doing shamatha, open awareness, writing an email, we are less under the power of the mind. We do want to weaken our attachment to thought. I think it actually makes your mind more fluid rather than making you a less functional person. I name that because sometimes there's the fear that we'll become less functional. Some of us depend on our intellects for a living and we worry, oh no, I don't want my mind to be empty. Empty doesn't mean absence of mind. It means transparency of mind. It means the lightness thoughts become like light bubbles. There's really no apt metaphor, but you have to experience it. So this practice is something you don't do for a long time. You don't do it for a long time, first of all, because you can't sustain that kind of intensity for a long time. And second, you want it to be fresh. In other words, if you do this practice sequence, ideally, you engage this practice as if you don't know what's going to happen. And that's an art for us as practitioners, no matter what kind of practice we're doing. We have to come at it without the assumption that we know what's going to happen. How do we disrupt the ho-hum attitude? That's a really important question, especially if you've been doing this for decades. It's not that it's not that we've exhausted the freshness or that we can exhaust the freshness of this practice, but we can bring a mind that says, oh, this isn't fresh. And it's all too easy to be bringing that mind into practice. So we do this practice in particular, the one of shining intense awareness, alert awareness on thoughts or on the mind that is absent of thought. You do it for a short period of time and then you let it go. It's a little bit of like the relaxation after an orgasm. You transition from that intense focus and melting thought and then you move into open awareness. What we sometimes call shikantaza, or at Great Vow, we call silent illumination. I'll continue with the sexual metaphors. You have lubricated things. With shamatha, you have lubricated the mind. With melting the fixity, by looking directly at thought, you have lubricated things. And then, the ideal is you're sitting in open awareness, in non-grasping natural presence, no seeking, just allowing the natural fullness of being, discovering what those words even mean. If they mean anything, you have to find out. It's empowered by having reduced our fixation with our ordinary mind. It's very hard, I think, in modern culture, maybe harder than ever, to just sit down and do a practice like shikantaza, open awareness, or so forth. Mm-hmm. We have very choppy, highly stimulated minds. On the other hand, this practice of open awareness, shikantaza, I mean, using these terms interchangeably, I know there's lots of nuance, and I'd love to talk about that with anybody who cares. Ideally, we're not favoring stillness. You know, Dogen Zenji said something about shikantaza. He said, when you sit shikantaza, you cast aside the distinction between stillness and activity. You let go of discriminating the mind is moving or it's not moving. It's that kind of openness, that kind of releasing. Another way to say it is you enact the space that is pristine, clear, and never moves. And within that, the mind dances. Within that, sensations come and go. But you embody, you enact that which is unmoved, and so it doesn't matter how much movement there is. There's an interesting phrase for this in the Vajrayana. They call it adornment. When you enact yourself as unmoving stillness, which is not something you attain, it's something you are, then the energy of the mind is, it's almost like an enhancement of that. That stillness is edified by being unmoved in the midst of movement. Koan Edjo, we do a chant at Great Vow sometimes called the Treasury of Divine Light Samadhi. And Koan Edjo, who was one of the Soto ancestors, said about this, he said, thoughts themselves arise as wisdom. In this soft but vivid mind, they can do that. In the grasping mind, they definitely don't arise as wisdom. Not the kind of wisdom he's talking about. Now, if you if you're doing this kind of threefold practice and you're doing this open awareness, and then you find that the mind once again gets choppy or you can't sustain it, this is an interesting place to consider. On one hand, if we go back to another practice and seek more clear ground, like, okay, I don't know what I'm doing, so let me at least concentrate on my toe, or let me at least focus on my breath, then we don't develop confidence in the open awareness. We don't develop confidence that even in this mess of the mind, I can embody this unmoving stillness, this pristine space. So that's something to consider. Of course, nobody knows what's going on in your meditation but you. At the end of the day, I'm afraid not even, maybe if you were right in front of them, a mature teacher could see something of your state of mind. But when you're at home, so there's something to be said for you just stick to it. And many of you have heard me go on my soapbox about not doing channel changing meditation. That is, channel changing meditation is, nowadays people have heard 7,000 meditation teachers talk about what's the best method to do. And there's lots of things in our minds. And so we sit down and we actually don't have confidence in any method because we've heard so many things. Well, Ajahn so-and-so said this, and Jogen, blah, blah, you know. And so what we do when it's not going how we think it should go, we search for a different method. We change. We go, oh, I should do such and such instead. Well, the tricky thing is sometimes you should, because you're the expert on your mind in that moment. I have no idea. I really don't want to know, probably. But the problem with the channel switching meditation is we have to give a particular method really a chance. The quality of resting in openness doesn't actually exclude concentration. Rather than open awareness being a technique, it's really more a stance. It's more an attitude towards experience. It's an orientation towards experience more than it is a specific technique. It's just not grasping. It's a total allowing of the life of the moment. And the only reason there's such a thing as the practice's open awareness is in contrast to our grasping as ordinary people. The only reason we even have such an idea of something like Shikantaza is because we're always trying to meddle with the moment. We're so busy trying to change experience. So it's not really a technique, it's an orientation. So within that open, that spacious welcoming, why not bring in the breath? Why not attune to the flow of the breath? It's not actually in opposition. Why not feel the sensations of your butt on the cushion to give you a little bit more traction in your body? If open awareness excludes those things, it's not really very open. It's actually rigid awareness. So, I wanted to just touch on tonight, for those of you who are working with this particular sequence of practices, and touch back into it. I'm looking at the text right now to see if there's anything else I want to say. Well, I'll be continuing with it. This text has these basic Buddhist contemplations in it that sandwich the practice, because I feel like it's very easy for us to slide into a secular approach to meditation, which is fine, but that's not what I want to teach. I mean, that's definitely not what Zen Buddhism is. And so these reflections on the nature of reality are just a reorienting to what Buddha Dharma is about.